Yes, well, thank you, Owen, and it's really glad to be here. And again, I would emphasise, like I said last year, I thank the people who behind the Physiology Award and the sponsors, Joe Hickey and his company. It's a great honour, and it's great to have such an award that has almost international sort of spread now. Firstly, I'm sorry we all have different accents, and I hope you can keep up with me. I'll do my best in talking slowly, and if we have trouble, Bill Weir over here can interpret for me. So the overview here is I wanted to do a little bit of historical stuff. I don't like talking about myself unless we're talking about football or golf or something. So I'll do a little bit of that, and then I'll talk a little bit about the future. And that, I guess, the title I decided on before I wrote the article, and I'm not sure whether or not the balance in these particular subjects is the same as what the title might say. But I'm going to try and address what is physiology as we go through, and I've even got a dollar in inverted commas there in brackets, because at some point in time we're all got to look for funding, and we I suppose need to find some relevance and reasons for having physiology, and unless we will lose funding at some point. So I found a couple of definitions of physiology, and they both sort of agreed with one another, even though they were probably 50 years apart. Not a particular great fan of Wikipedia, but it is something quick that you can look at. But the definition gives us wide scope, and sometimes that's a good thing, and sometimes it's a challenge, because the word physiology means different things to different people. But there's a wide scope of subjects in there that are covered by physiology, all the way from molecular biology through to agronomy and farming systems. And that's good, but it can create sort of almost translation problems sometimes when you've got a molecular biologist sort of talking to you. But my personal definition is that physiology is about the processes. firstly, just in terms of some important older work, I wanted to just highlight a couple of bits of work. One was some old work from the 30s, and the other is the work of Hesketh and others. So I'll just have a couple of slides illustrating where I thought these were useful bits of work, and for those of you that are graduate students, it just highlights, I think, that there's still a need to read some literature, and particularly those that precede finding them on the web. And there are others, many, many others, and some in the room here, I guess, as well, but there's some older work by Eaton here in the US and by Brian Hearn in Africa and in Australia. So Crowther, he did work on water and nitrogen back in the 1930s, and he had this, and it was in the Sudan, of course, and when I was looking at his table, the units are in some funny units, and when I eventually worked them out, it was 0.6 bales to the acre, his top yield, which isn't very impressive, but what I wanted to highlight was that the work that he did, he was able to really do some quite incisive interpretation of what was going on. This particular graph I've got here, it's just the flowering rates, or relative flowering rates, of the different water and nitrogen treatments. But the interpretation he had was roughly, I'm not going to read all this out, but the first couple of lines there is that he felt that the nitrogen was required for the initiation of the fruiting sites, and water was required for the growth of and the development of the fruiting branch and the flower and the bowl that came from that. Again, as I said, I'm not going to read that, but we tend to have this obsession in cotton with the fact that it's an indeterminate plant and that we should be taking that into consideration a lot. And I guess I've had some uncertainty about that as time's gone on, that we've been obsessed with it, and at other times I think we can ignore it. I think in the modern production system at high yield levels, it probably is quite a determinate crop. But when you end up with some particular problems or stresses during the year, that indeterminate growth habit does turn out to be something you do need to take into account. And he cited some work from the 20s talking about the similar competition in the plant, which just does highlight that we're probably not all making a lot of invention, that we're just following up on what somebody else might have started. But the second last line there, the plant appears to be a victim of its own morphological processes, is sort of saying that it eventually does become determinate anyway. Hesketh and a whole lot of other people did a lot of work, and I'm not going to go through these, but I've highlighted, in fact, that John Hesketh did spend a year or so in Australia, and there's a couple of publications in there that were from that. But I was just going to highlight two or three papers that I thought were quite useful And even under the present circumstances, the first one was the work that they did at this particular conference in 1969 was the theoretical yield. I calculated that from photosynthesis and respiration measurements. The theoretical yield was 7.6 bales to the acre. And at the time, I guess everybody was getting 1 or 2 bales to the acre, and it seemed like a long way away, but we're getting much closer to that 7.6 these days. And I think it was a pretty good bit of work, and it was quite an accurate estimate. Another bit of work that went into, and I've got a particular fetish with respiration, I suppose, because I felt when I was doing my work that I didn't understand it for a long while, and I needed to see a few references that did explain it, and that this is just a graph out of the 1971 paper, but the measurements of maintenance respiration here of about 0.3% of dry weight, which is a very small amount, and gross respiration, which was about right, I guess. They followed up on that later, but I'll talk about it. But that was the first of the papers dealing with respiration and growth, which I do believe really helped our understanding of growth. But there was a subsequent one that John Heskett did with John Thornley, who's a British fellow. They got a lower estimate of maintenance respiration, but they got a very high error on that. You see the error is much greater than the mean they got there. And the reason for that is that I highlight here later that I don't believe respiration should be based on a dry weight. I think it should be based on the protein content of the tissue that you're talking about. And if you do take that into account, I believe that the maintenance respiration would become a lot less error. And the other thing is that the respiration is very strongly affected by temperature. In fact, it more than doubles for every 10 degree rise in temperature. And that example I've done there where about 5% of the weight of a bowl is needed for respiration. Under high temperature conditions, that does become a massive constraint on the assimilates that the plant might have at that time. And then the last one, the other paper that relationship between light and photosynthesis on a ground area is used in a lot of models, Gossiam and even our own OSCOT in Australia. It's an important relationship, and it's quite an obvious one, but it's got the right units in each place. There was a comment on VPD in the paper, which I think is more relevant these days than what they had at the time. They ignored it in that time, but I think it's going to become important if climate change is real or perceived to be real. I want to move now to Australian situation, and our industry in a modern context started in the 60s. We're all export these days. I don't think we have any spinning mills left in Australia. And I've got a rhetorical question there. How can physiology help the industry? Bottom left-hand corner there, I've got just some dates there that the first fleet from England actually carried cotton seed because they'd already identified that there was potential to grow cotton there to supply to the mills in the UK. And it worked its way up the coast. From when Sydney was first settled, they worked their way up the coast, and the start of successful production was in what we would call central Queensland there at Billawela, and the modern industry started back down here in the Nemoi Valley where we come from, Mick and I, in the early 1960s with people that had come from California. And that's our production record since then, in all area, not production, sorry. And you can see our current circumstances with regard to drought. We're back to about a third of what our normal area might be. And I guess when you look at a graph like that, nothing's normal. But there was a lot of growth. There wasn't much growth through the 70s, but into the 80s and 90s, there was a lot of expansion in the industry. So we've got a cost-price squeeze. I suppose that's always been the case. The yield is increasing about a tenth of a bale per hectare per year, sorry for the units, and the costs are increasing at double that. So by the year 2022, if those lines are real, it would be, you'd be growing cotton for charity, essentially. But our issues would be, in terms of those lines, is the yield, the price and the costs. I don't believe we can do a lot about the costs. So the yield and the price of the quality are issues that we would like to deal with. there are perceptions and realities about the water use efficiency, nutrient use efficiency, and energy use efficiency these days. And I believe physiology has roles to play in addressing some of those circumstances. And I will now move to some of the issues that I've dealt with through my career. As I said, I'm not going to talk about myself for very long at all, and I'm only going to deal with those two in the middle that are highlighted in what should be blue instead of grey. But I have dealt with those particular subjects in order, and the bottom two are the more what I deal with in my job these days, particularly the bottom one. So this is a fundamental bit of data that I did in the late 70s, I guess, was the relationship between leaf photosynthesis at full light and the age of a leaf. So a very young leaf is very small, but a low capacity for growth or for photosynthesis. And at about the time that the leaf is full size, it reaches full rate of photosynthesis and then drops off. And by 70 or 80 days, the leaf is starting to become a bit of a passenger and it starts to fall off. By integrating each of those numbers, and this is one lesson that I learnt in this work that I was doing, I had to come up with ways of integrating all the information. This is the same time scale in days from leaf unfolding on a particular node and how much carbon per leaf per day was produced in either net photosynthesis or the top line, respiration and growth, and so this second bottom line, the second top line, is the amount of export, and depending on the amount of light, that value is about a milligram per square centimetre per day. I did the same thing for fruit, likewise the same sort of symbols there. There is some photosynthesis or net photosynthesis during the day by bracts, although the units are quite small. The scale changes here on each side. And so here's this, the amount of growth required on this symbol there on that bottom right-hand graph is the amount of import required to support a bulb for its growth and respiration. So you can integrate all of those. I don't know why that's changing. I didn't press anything. You can do the same thing for whole nodes and whole plants. And the one point that I found from these that was of relevance was that the production and of assimilates at a node and the consumption by the bowls at that node were not synchronous, so there always had to be longer term transport from above those bowls to support their growth. And in doing some assimilate distribution, these plots are just an example of some of the work that I did. The left-hand column is a log transformation of the amount of assimilate in a bowl, and the x-axis is the main stem leaf number. And I had wet and dry treatments there, and I don't like using this pointer because it keeps changing on me. The left-hand graph, that 5/60 is there, is leaf 5 when it's 60 days of age, and the next graph is leaf 13 at 35 days of age, and left and right in each scale. And the solid line is fitted through the black dots, which are the bowls on the same size of the main stem as the leaf that was labelled with C14. With the phyllotaxy, the assimilate movement is more vertical than it is horizontal around the plant. The important part of this is that under dry conditions or under stress, the assimilate distribution changed direction altogether from going upwards maybe to mainly downwards. And again, as I said before, you can integrate all of these numbers, and these two bar charts here, the histograms on there are the calculated carbon supply to those particular bowls. From the leaf profile of carbon production, which is the graph. And I've turned these around to the way they should be, with the node number going from bottom to top on the y-axis, and the carbon supply in milligrams per day on the x-axis. And the bottom histogram is the assimilate transport to the roots. And so the top left-hand one was the wet treatment, and the bottom right-hand one was the treatment that had the cumulative stress. And the amount and the distribution can be seen there. And these are ways in which I had to integrate the information from having photosynthetic rates and a similar transport by using carbon 14 labelling. It highlighted the fact that under dry conditions, the plant was able to maintain those roots for the assimilates that were required, because there was no growth on top, essentially, and that allowed for growth to be maintained down the bottom. So that work on photosynthesis and assimilate distribution, was that worthwhile? And I'd like to say yes, but I guess I'm biased. But I think in terms of the application of this work, that the accurate interpretation is required for correct subsequent management action. It's like if your car's broken down with a flat battery, putting new tyres on it won't really change it. So if you make the wrong interpretation of a problem in the field, you're not necessarily going to be taking the right action. And that knowledge does give growers or consultants or the people who might need this information more confidence in taking management action. This understanding of the balance between source and sink was, I think, something worthwhile. As I mentioned before, our obsession with the plant being indeterminate is sometimes justified and sometimes not, but some of this knowledge of the carbon budget and some of the factors affecting it does help us with all of those issues of agronomy we need to deal with. And including the bowl size profile that is a consequence of the shape of those graphs, that the bowls in the middle of the plant are bigger than the bowls on the top or the bottom. That is of great importance for us in Australia, where we used to have a lot of insect damage from Heliothus, and the compensation for that damage needs to take into account whether or not you're going to be putting bigger or smaller bowls back where they are replacing what might have been a bigger or smaller bowl. And as I mentioned, this required a sort of a model to integrate all of this information. And some of the gaps I'd identified when I was trying to do that was this dark respiration. And I guess the information has been really helpful in strategic analysis for future agronomy and even breeding, as I'll get onto in a moment. And I guess you can judge that rather than me say that it was worthwhile or not. With Brian Hearn, we did a lot of work in irrigation in the field over a number of years, and we were after not only yield per hectare, but yield per megalitre of water or per acre feet. I'm sorry about the units. And we even did work on irrigation systems with drip irrigation compared with the furrow irrigation that you see in the slide there is what our normal system looks like. So just as a summary slide for what might have been 5 or 6 years worth of work there, that water stress, which we defined as 24 bars in the crop, reduced yield by 0.8% per day of stress at first flower, double that at peak flower, and 1.4% per day at early bowl maturation, and hardly measurable in terms of yield towards the end of the season. Increasing nitrogen uptake by increased yield by 1% for every kilogram of nitrogen taken up. And there were great interactions. So if you had early and medium stress in the crop, that did more than, for example, the 1.8 and the 1.6. If you had stress at first flower and peak flower, the reduction in yield was greater than 2.4% per day. And there's interactions with nitrogen, which are fairly easily understood. Something that appeared in our data because of the soil you can see there being a heavy alkaline sodic clay, waterlogging reduced nitrogen uptake by a kilogram of nitrogen for every day of waterlogging. And that reduced yield by 1%. And then as an indirect, that was an indirect method, and more direct reduction in yield was about 1.9% per day. I think we overestimated waterlogging in those particular experiments because we had some soil compaction in some of the experiments, but it did highlight waterlogging to be so important. And we've subsequently done some more work, and Warren Connerty, who's currently doing a PhD at home, did this as an undergraduate project, just comparing the different a range of varieties for their reaction to waterlogging. And there were a few varieties that were more sensitive to waterlogging than others when measured by leaf colour. And as it turned out, the three varieties on the right-hand side are our modern varieties, and I guess through our breeding in the last 20 or 30 years, we've been indirectly selecting for adaptation to those conditions anyway. So the more modern varieties, I think, had the least reduction in colour and in yield. Taking all those factors into account that I mentioned before, it was possible, and this was Brian Hearn's particular interest in this area of going through our long-term historical weather records to determine what management strategies were appropriate or what were best. And because we have very variable climate, you get a very broad range of outcomes in terms of the amount of water that you allocate to the crop and the yield that you might expect. So that does allow the producers really to evaluate the risk that they may or may not want to take, or may emphasise, I think, how important it would be to have better or more reliable weather predictions. So if you wanted to be on average 6 megalitres per hectare or 2 acre feet was required, and that was what they decided even before the cotton cropping started, so the people who established the irrigation area got it right probably. But in very dry seasons, like we've been having recently, 8 megalitres per hectare is required for maximum yield. And this provided comprehensive information on crop management strategies and risks or that the people could take with regard to water. So I moved into plant breeding some years ago, and I'd done that probably because I wasn't getting bored, but I was looking for a new challenge. But more in retrospect than any plans, as it's turned out, the modern technology, biotechnology traits have really changed the way the crop has grown in Australia, from having had a lot of insect damage to having plants that now look normal, or what you might see as normal. That's probably changed some of the aspects of management in the crop, and I notice there's a paper or two about that in the conference in the next day or so. But the plant type for us has really changed. We used to have varieties that were more what we would call earlier than you would probably call them mid, but we had them. Those varieties have dropped out of our system altogether because they really just weren't big enough to hold the early boll loads that we now have with Bollgard 2 especially. My other interest was that breeding is an important area of as a platform for future traits, and I don't think I'm the first person to think of that. And we have a successful program. I wasn't going to go and join any losers. I think the CSIRO program was quite successful at the time, and I felt quite excited about joining that team. And again, just in terms of, I mentioned research management there before, the strategic knowledge does help me, I hope, and I'll leave others to judge. Mick maybe can comment if whether or not my strategic knowledge has helped us. I've got a photo there of a crop of 5.2 bales to the acre. I've got the right units there, I guess, for you. But the crops that we're occasionally getting near 6 bales to the acre look just the same. The visual assessment of these, I just don't have it. I cannot pick the fives from the sixes, but the pickers definitely can. So the future, I'm only spending, I guess, less than 5 minutes on the future, and I think the future's more important than that, but there's a lot of competition out there with the synthetics in the fibre market. That's not news to any of us, and we need to continually improve our product, I guess, on that basis. But with grains for land and water, which both your country and ours is having that particular debate, and there was a little spike in that, I guess, last year with the relative prices, and for us it's gone back to something like it was before. Future climate, I guess both countries have had elections in the last year or so, and climate change and global warming and those sorts of subjects are getting a bit of airing. I guess we're predicted to be hotter, drier and more variable, and we're already hot, dry and variable, so that's a bit scary. The high CO2 can't be disputed, I guess. And I think there's a gap in our knowledge, particularly in maybe field data anyway, with the interaction between high CO2 and water deficit and high vapour pressure, that there is a gap, we believe, in that area that we'd like to address. I'd mentioned nutrition earlier on with the old Crowther paper. I count nutrition as being in the scope of physiology, and I guess in terms of yield, increasing the uptake of potassium and phosphorus is an important target. I guess we can load the plant up with lots of nitrogen, but we don't seem to be able to get much more P and K into the plant no matter what we do. So what tools will help us progress down that route with some of those particular opportunities there? I've mentioned waterlogging. We're taking a transgenic approach to that at home, and I'll mention that in a moment. Water stress, for our particular circumstances in our environment, in breeding, we find indeterminate growth habit is of most value, because the rain is not predictable, and when it does come, you need to have a plant that's able to take advantage and do some growth, or take some growth and set some bowls whenever that rain does occur. And for us, Aqua Relief does do it for us. There are traits out there. Monsanto and others have stress gene traits, and some of these are already in field trials and more advanced, some more advanced than others in some crops. And as I mentioned before, this needing to have particular plant types for some of these traits will be different with some of these agronomic traits to what has been the case with the insect and herbicide traits. Heat stress. Breeders have been developing heat tolerance for many years, particularly over here to the west, no doubt. And I'll just highlight a little bit of new research that we're doing, really just trying to address some of the perceptions, I suppose, with regard to climate change. Our soils are sodic, so we think sodicity is quite important, and we have a lot of data indicating that the sodium does interfere with phosphorus and potassium uptake. So I'm going to show two of these. It's not my work, it's others, which I try to acknowledge on the bottom of the slide there. These are the outputs of some software from microarrays, and the particular little greens and red colours in this particular case highlight genes or enzymes that have been up or down regulated by a particular treatment. So on this particular slide, it shows green and red. I'm not wanting to illustrate any particular one, but that there's more than one gene that's switched on when a plant's put under challenge, which shouldn't be a surprise to anybody. But does this sort of technology is out there now to identify what is really going on and where and under what particular metabolic pathways are being affected by, and in this case, waterlogging. And there's a range of pathways that have been affected. In our particular case, we're engineering the plant to overexpress an Arabidopsis hemoglobin gene, as well as some alcohol dehydrogenase and pyruvate decarboxylase enzymes to sort of provide the plant with some pathways to deal with waterlogging. And that we do have field research just starting in those particular traits. Heat stress, so again, here's another example, and this student, Nicola Cotti, did spend 6 months over here in the States with Tom Costerin's group, and so the mean of these graphs actually is Narrabri and College Station photosynthetic rates for a control, which was actually 38 degrees C, which wasn't particularly cold, I guess, with 44 degrees C with plants in tents. And there's two varieties there that you would not be familiar with, obviously, but there is a difference there. And again, the same sorts of technologies with microarrays have identified the sort of heat shock proteins and glycolysis proteins that have been affected more so than many others in this particular case. And this microarray was done between the two cultivars at high temperature, just showing which enzymes were more affected than others. We're hoping to utilise this sort of information to speed up breeding for heat tolerance. Another area that I think is becoming important, and it addresses the subject I mentioned before about having these the right plant type with some of these new areas, yield components. So what are we going to do if we end up with somebody increasing growth rates? Are we going to all end up with micronaires of 5.5? So a lot of those types of issues need to be dealt with as well. And yield a topic I call yield engineering. Kate Hake, I know, just left a minute ago, he gave a good talk about this at Cape Town in 2003, but that Monsanto's stress gene trait and others would fit in this category as well. So I guess that they are long-term issues, and I'm not sure how successful they'll be, but I think we're not going to get anywhere if we don't start looking at them much more carefully and intensively. So my summary is that I believe physiology and the like are noble professions, Owen. You wouldn't disagree, I know, but I'd say that. And with the right research team balance, I'm not saying that everybody should be working on this. In terms of our group, we believe just the right amount of that in terms of a team is very important and adds considerable value to the research and the impact that it might have. And I think the collaboration or the opportunities between crop physiology and molecular biology is there now. And the water stress example I gave, or the heat stress example I gave a moment ago, the studies at the crop, leaf, cell and gene level are all possible now. And we offer the molecular biology people some relevance. So if you're wanting them to decide between working more in Arabidopsis or moving into a crop with a little bit of relevance, it's something you can do. My physiology definition is that it's one job, what John Hesketh used to do, adding some modern tools. And just to follow on as I finish, Owen, the Arabidopsis in cotton, they share 75% of genes, I've been told. And just to get that into context, monkeys and humans share 98. So with that, I'll leave it at that. Thank you.